are a consequence of underlying structures that enable these things to happen. And you can't have any sort of functional humanitarianism without political systems that are driven by a set of values and principles, and that we apply consistently across settings, not just when it's politically and economically convenient. There are obligations under international humanitarian law that ensure the safety of healthcare workers, the safety of unhindered humanitarian access, including the delivery of food. But at the moment, over 8 million people in Sudan face emergency or famine level food insecurity, according to the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the IPA classification system.
And Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, I mean, you pointed out that in the place that you're in, where you worked, that's actually the agricultural center, and yet children were so severely malnourished. We only have 20 seconds.
Yeah, no, that's true and very shocking. And I think Professor Alec Duvall sort of pointed to some of the structural reasons why that's the case. You know, people can be very poor with very little access to resources that are at, you know, arm's reach, as we've heard a lot over the last 2 years in conflicts throughout the world. And that's why
Dr. Tania Haj Hassan, I'm so sorry, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Tania Haj Hassan and Alex Duvall, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation. And that does it for today's show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, federal officers hit daytime protesters at the Portland ICE facility hard.
A federal order blocking the National Guard deployment in Portland goes to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
And local veterans call on service members to disobey illegal orders.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 6, 2025. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Federal officers hit daytime demonstrators with tear gas and other munitions at the Portland ICE facility. Protesters over the weekend. KBOO's Anna Wilcox reports.
The federal reaction to the protests in Portland escalated over the weekend. Federal officers used tear gas during a planned daytime demonstration and took several people into the ICE building. Five protesters were transferred to the Columbia County Jail. Portland local Jaron Anzaldúa remains in custody. It was their first protest. The demonstration was put on by the local group Portland Contra las Deportaciones, which is Portland Against Deportations in English.
So we're trying to get the permit revoked from the ICE building, and so we have less than 60 days to get that consideration. So we're out here making noise and putting a community pressure.
Their current permit bars ICE from detaining any person inside the building for longer than 12 hours. They have violated their permit 25 times since October of last year. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson issued a formal notice to ICE about the violations last month.
It was only after months of protest from you that City Council even acknowledged the problem. It was only after we disrupted their meetings and disrupted Mayor Wilson's interview with Bike Portland that they finally issued a notice of violation for ICE's condition.
Saturday's rally began with speeches in Elizabeth Caruthers Park, followed by a short march to the ICE building. An estimated 400 people were present, including youth and seniors. Participants were unarmed and many lacked masks or goggles. Demonstration organizer Holly Brown was among those arrested. Brown was charged with trespassing on federal property. They were taken into the ICE facility and held for approximately 4 hours before being released back into the crowd.
We were placed in these different holding cells, and inside the holding cells, there's no bedding or anything comfortable to sit on. It's just metal and concrete. And, you know, on the walls of these holding cells, there are actually posters that are encouraging people to self-deport and offering them money to self-deport. So the situation in there was pretty grim. And also the officers and the agents that were inside there were incredibly disrespectful and cruel. I was originally placed in a holding cell with one of my friends, and we were covered in gas. So we basically, like, we had, you know, shirts on underneath, so we took off, like, the shirts that we were wearing.
Brown was met by a small crowd of demonstrators and press after their release. Counter-protesters interrupted Brown's interview.
Released from the ICE facility.
Getting this building shut down, and also getting ICE out of Portland, stopping the deportation of our neighbors.
Federal officers used tear gas again later in the evening, pushing protesters back down the block. OPB reporter Troy Brennelson was on the scene and said that there was no apparent reason to use tear gas. Federal officers have used tear gas and other noxious chemicals at the scene for months with varying intensity. Protesters wear protective gear to avoid injury from the gas. Volunteer medics on site routinely treat people harmed by the noxious chemicals. KBOO talked to a volunteer medic on Saturday.
I've had patients that have had their eye protection pulled off and sprayed underneath their eye protection, which is pretty severe. They don't use chemical weapons every night. Sometimes it's like 5 times a week, sometimes it's 2 times a week. Really depends on the week, depends on the month. But when they just kind of shoot the bullets or do very targeted sprays, could be anywhere from like 2 to 5 people in a night. When they do more severe crowd control measures, it could be dozens.
Saturday afternoon, right-wing influencer Katie Davis-Court stepped onto a lower roof of the ICE building and filmed the crowd with her phone. On another occasion, camera operators emerged from the facility to film the crowd from behind the guards.
So, like, within the last couple of days, they've, like, once or twice invited those right-wing reporters to come in and do stuff. But this is the first time I've seen that they've had their what seems to be their own media presence.
A woman with a vest marked ERO stepped out among the guards to film the demonstrators with her phone. ERO stands for Enforcement Removal Operations. The American flag flies at half-mast atop the ICE building. There's a sign inside that you can read through the window. Presidents are temporary. Wu-Tang is forever. For KBOO News and Pacifica Radio, I'm Anna Wilcox.
Late on Sunday, U.S. District Judge Karen Imrigut broadened her ruling on a temporary restraining order. No National Guard members from anywhere in the country should be deployed to Oregon. This comes after her Saturday ruling blocking the Oregon National Guard from being deployed in Portland. In response, the Trump administration prepared to send 300 already federalized National Guard troops from California to Portland and more from Texas. That led Imrigut to broaden the order blocking National Guard members from other parts of the country. Imrigut said in her ruling, quote, "I'm troubled by the direct contravention of my prior order," end quote. Imrigut was appointed to her position by Trump in his first term. She agreed with the plaintiffs in the case, the City of Portland and Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield, that there was not a situation on the streets that demanded the National Guard's intervention. The Trump administration is appealing to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which could hear and rule in the case today. Lawyers for Trump argue in their filings, quote, "There is no statutory requirement that the president's determination must be made in a written decision cataloging its factual basis," end quote.
If the ban on the National Guard holds, Trump could send in active duty military personnel. Leaked signal chats first reported by the Minnesota Star Tribune showed the Trump administration plans to send the 82nd Airborne Division to Portland. They're an elite army unit that specializes in parachute assaults and forced entry operations. A senior advisor to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth wrote on Signal, quote, "Between you and I think Pete just wants the top cover from the boss if anything goes sideways with the troops there," end quote. He continued, saying Hegseth wanted direct orders from Trump to do it. If active duty military members do come to Portland, court challenges to the action change. The legal question becomes about states' rights and what the troops would be used for at the federal building. If troops are carrying out ICE raids, that would likely violate the Posse Comitatus Act. That law prevents the military from acting as civilian law enforcement, but any appearance of troops on Portland streets is likely to inflame tensions on the street. Tun Ying is a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School. Ying told Oregon Live, quote, "It's almost the president manufacturing the very warlike conditions he's been asserting give him the right to do this," end quote.
Veterans rallied outside Portland City Hall Sunday against the deployment of National Guard troops and additional ICE agents to Portland. The event was called Duty to Disobey, Veterans Stand Against War on American Soil. Portland City Councilor Mitch Green is a veteran of war in Afghanistan. He encouraged veterans to take a stand and use their privilege to call attention to the Trump administration's unlawful acts.
"Like so many Portlanders, I'm angry, I'm frustrated, and appalled at the willingness of this administration to turn the military against us, against American cities who refuse to submit to his overtly racist and dehumanizing program of mass deportation. It has never been more important to use your voice to speak out against the actions of this federal administration. And veterans, you have a special voice. Society has granted us the benefit of doubt when it comes to respectability and honor. At least twice a year, we get thanked for our service, right? You get a free breakfast at, Denny's? Is it still there? The unspoken agreement in that deal, though, is that we are supposed to remain silent when our service is used as a prop for the same militarization that injured our bodies and stained our souls, and that killed our brothers and sisters and countless civilians.
That's right.
If you break that agreement on your own, you could be shunned, right? But if we use our veterans' voices to speak from a place of experience and solidarity and reject the ongoing militarization of not just our hometowns, but the grander project, then we are powerful, and we can lead an important part of what must be a mass mobilization."
Mike Preisner is a veteran with the group About Face, Veterans Against the War. He addressed rank-and-file members of the military, saying the Trump administration was working to consolidate power and suppress dissent in upper ranks.
"And as a veteran of the Iraq War, and having had to spend 2 decades reflecting every day on that experience, I am compelled to tell young soldiers today that just because an order is considered lawful does not mean it is right. Everyone knows in their heart of hearts that this is not right. When something is not right, you have to take a stand. What they have done is to make the burden of protecting democracy and constitutional rights fall on the rank and file soldiers and to junior officers, to the enlisted. That is not a burden you have chosen as soldiers. That is not a burden that you deserve, but it is a burden that this administration has placed upon you."
Preisner and Green encourage service members to seek out support in opposing orders they believe are unlawful. Hear extended comments from Preisner and Councilor Green later in the show at 5:45 on KBOO News in Depth.
New research finds adults age 70 and above are the most likely to die by firearm suicide, and Oregon has one of the highest rates of firearm suicide in the country. The data also finds that people living rurally are at much higher risk. Isabel Charlet has more.
The study finds over 63,000 older Americans died by gun suicide from 2009 to 2023. Oregon has one of the country's highest rates of firearm suicide, with nearly 1,400 such deaths. Data journalist Aaron Mendelson says this trend is driven partly by the nation's growing population of older adults, which has nearly doubled in 20 years. He warns that without intervention, the problem will continue to worsen.
So we thought looking at the data and just starting from that point would be a good way to approach this subject that is often really challenging to discuss, even though it happens far more than I think many people realize.
The data shows a sharp gender and racial disparity, with the highest gun suicide rates among white men over 70. Mendelson adds the rates are much higher in rural communities, which is true in Oregon as well. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call or text the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988. I'm Isabel Charlet.
The Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Ghislaine Maxwell today on the first day of their new term. Maxwell is the imprisoned former girlfriend of Jeffrey Epstein. The justices, in a private session, declined to take up the case that most likely would have drawn fresh attention to the long-standing sexual abuse saga. Donald Trump's administration has tried to draw attention away from their refusal to publicly release more investigative files from the Epstein case. And Trump's administrator urged the high court to stay out of the case. Lawyers for Maxwell argued that she never should have been tried or convicted for her role luring teenage girls to be sexually abused by Epstein. They say a non-prosecution agreement between federal prosecutors and Epstein's lawyers also protected his, quote, potential co-conspirators from charges. She is serving a 20-year prison term in a minimum security facility in Texas. Her trial featured accounts from the sexual exploitation of girls as young as 14, as told by four women who described being abused at Epstein's homes. Maxwell was given limited immunity, allowing her to speak freely without fear of prosecution for anything she said, except for false statements. She repeatedly denied witnessing any sexually inappropriate interactions involving Donald Trump. The Epstein case was a major focus on Trump's campaign. But now, the Justice Department says, based on the evidence they have, no further disclosure would be appropriate or warranted. Trump addressed the issue at a cabinet meeting, calling people who fell for what he called the Jeffrey Epstein hoax, quote, weaklings.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth report on Catherine Dunn's news story collection, Near Flesh, with her son, Eli DePolonia, and Jim Redden of Oregon Arts Watch. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of about 48 degrees. Tomorrow, look for sunshine and warm temperatures with a high of about 76. Today in history, in 1941, American gay rights activist Paul Popham was born. He was a founder of the New York-based AIDS service organization, Gay Men's Health Crisis, and he was its president from 1981 to 1985. The quote of the day is from American actress Betty Davis, who died this day in 1989. She said, quote, to fulfill a dream, to be allowed to sweat over lonely labor, to be given a chance to create, is the meat and potatoes of life. The money is the gravy.
Some legal experts warn that government shutdown messaging blaming one political party may violate the Hatch Act, which bars federal officials from using their authority for partisan purposes. They argue enforcement is inconsistent and undermines accountability at the highest level of government. Judith Rios Branch reports.
The Hatch Act prevents officials from using their authority to politicize the federal workplace, and it ensures nonpartisan administration of government programs. Delaney Marsco with Campaign Legal Center says things like government websites displaying messages that blame one political party for the government shutdown are skirting the line of Hatch Act violations.
Specifically mentioning a political party, kind of targeting a political party, does come a little bit closer to that definition of what political activity is.
Marsco emphasizes enforcement challenges of the Hatch Act, particularly for senior officials supervised by the president. She explains lower-level employees often face disciplinary action for violations, but senior officials rarely do, creating an accountability gap at the highest levels of government. About 18,000 federal government employees in Wisconsin could be impacted by the shutdown and potential layoffs. I'm Judith Ruiz Branch reporting.
House Democrats are reassuring their constituents about the reason for the government shutdown. Federal workers are concerned about being in the middle of the partisan fight. And what happens now that the farm bill has expired? With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Whether or not Republicans want to acknowledge it and whether they want to lie about it by saying it's only going to be for undocumented immigrants, the reality is next January you'll be paying that much if they do not act now.
Virginia Democratic Representative Suha Subramaniam says they're blocking government funding to defend people's access to health care. He says they want to restore hundreds of billions of cuts from Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies in the GOP mega bill, which provided tax breaks for the wealthy. Republicans argue Democrats want to give health care to illegal immigrants, but those migrants are in fact ineligible for the programs. One poll found more than 4 out of every 5 Americans across parties support the Affordable Care Act subsidies, making insurance less expensive. Another found voters blame Republicans more for the shutdown by a narrow margin. It's unlikely the Senate will vote soon on any compromise proposals, and the House will be out of session this week. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says he wants to pressure Senate Democrats who he says are blocking funding to appease their base, and because Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is afraid of his voters.
Chuck Schumer is a far-left progressive politician, but he's not far enough left for this base. And so he's got to show a fight against the president. He's got to show that he's fighting Republicans.
States like New York estimate the impacts of ending the ACA subsidies will be drastic when combined with the Medicaid cuts. Nathan Dusdorf is with the Fiscal Policy Institute.
The Department of Health has estimated that failing to extend these tax credits will cause healthcare costs in New York to rise by 38% for the 140,000 individual market enrollees, and it will cut funding to the Essential Plan, which provides healthcare to 1.7 million New Yorkers.
Meanwhile, thousands of vital federal employees are working without pay. Rourke Hotop with the American Federation of Government Employees says administration cuts and layoffs are hitting already underfunded agencies, which were never bloated in the first place.
The VA has been chronically understaffed and underfunded for years. And so when we do have complaints about the VA and its wait times, you know, I would say, well, fund it and staff it more than 75% and see how great it is.
Legal experts say administration rhetoric about the shutdown may actually break the law that prohibits using public office for political ends. The Hatch Act prevents officials from using their authority to politicize the federal workplace and ensures nonpartisan administration of government programs. But Delaney Marsco with Campaign Legal Center says government websites are now displaying messages blaming the Democrats for the shutdown.
Specifically mentioning a political party, kind of targeting a political party, does come a little bit closer to that definition of what political activity is.
She notes lower-level employees often face disciplinary action for Hatch Act violations, but senior officials rarely do, creating an accountability gap. The long-delayed farm bill is still up in the air. It hasn't been updated in 7 years and expired while lawmakers were busy grappling with the budget. Michael Happ with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says Congress needs to understand farmers are in a much different situation than they were in 2018.
Input costs are through the roof. Corn prices in particular are way down. And then we have the uncertainty from the tariffs.
The Trump administration says it's looking at bailing out soybean and row crop farmers hit hard by the trade battles with China. Due to the shutdown, farming programs focused on conservation, research, and clean energy can't function, which Happ says is leading to confusion, frustration, and an erosion of trust. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Tribes along the Great Lakes have a new climate change impact guide to help them adapt to changing conditions. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A resource guide to help small and medium-sized governments in the Great Lakes region adapt to climate change has been published. Chuck Kornbach reports that some tribal communities in the area are already trying to reduce problems caused by higher temperatures and additional flooding.
The guide is from the International Joint Commission, or IJC, which helps implement the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 between the U.S. and Canada. Liz Kirkwood of the IJC's Water Quality Board says climate change has brought more severe storms, loss of ice cover, and extreme temperatures to much of North America, including the Great Lakes region.
In 2024, extreme weather disasters cost the eight Great Lakes states more than $13 billion U.S. dollars combined. Some of the costliest disasters happened in the last 5 years.
While debate continues over how to reduce air pollution that contributes to climate change, the IJC has published a guide aimed at helping small and medium-sized governments adapt to the new temperatures and heavier rainfalls. Charlie Rasmussen of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission says his organization welcomes the sharing of best practices, funding ideas, and other strategies. He says the commission's 11 Ojibwe member tribes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota are already taking steps, sometimes in collaboration with local, state, or federal agencies. One project being Ishkade. That's using prescribed or controlled fires on land next to water.
They help maintain and reestablish native species that do the best job at holding the soil and able to resist, you know, some of these severe precipitation events.
Rasmussen says other tribes are putting in larger roadside culverts to reduce highway damage from flooding and to help wildlife move. He says tribes also share TEK, or traditional ecological knowledge.
It encourages building relationships with plants, animals, and water as living beings rather than just a natural resource that you manage.
The International Joint Commission says it recognizes its climate adaptation guide has some gaps, including needing more content from First Nations and island communities. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Quernbach.
Family, friends, and colleagues from across Indian country gathered Friday and Saturday on the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin for funeral services to honor Ernie Stevens Jr., chairman of the Indian Gaming Association. Stevens is being remembered as a longtime advocate for Indian country and for making strides in Indian gaming. During visitation on Friday streamed online, his son Brandon Stevens said he was an amazing tribal leader who fought for Native voices, sovereignty, and future generations. And above all else, he said he was a family man.
To his family, he was more than a leader. He was a man who loved us without hesitation, who protected us, and who always reminded us that family is everything. No matter what we did in our lives, good, bad, or ugly, he looked straight through us and said, "You are my children, and I love you."
Stevens died suddenly at age 66 on September 26th. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says temporary federal funding for 14 tribal broadcasting stations in Alaska from the Bureau of Indian Affairs will help keep the lights on, but says the job is not done. In a recent statement, Murkowski said the funding will help some of the state's most rural radio stations make ends meet for now, but it's one-time funding. $10 million in BIA existing funding will support Native-serving stations in the U.S. This follows the rescission by Congress of $1.1 billion for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. October 1st marked the first day public media operated without federal funding. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new law in Washington state makes sure that tribes are able to appoint their own representatives to local boards of health. Backers of the law say it will lead to more collaboration across governments. Isabel Charlet has more on that story.
The change clarifies a 2020 state law that requires local boards of health to include members who are not elected officials, including tribal representatives. Vicki Lowe is with the American Indian Health Commission, a nonprofit that works with the state to promote wellness in Washington's Native communities. She says the previous language was not clear about who was responsible for appointing tribal representatives to health boards or how many seats were available.
I'm hoping going forward we can get more tribes on these local boards of health and the local relationship and working together to keep all of our community healthy and safe will happen.
Every county in the state has a local board of health that is tasked with enforcing health laws, controlling infectious diseases, and setting local policies. Of Washington's 29 federally recognized tribes, Lowe says so far about 15 have appointed someone to their local board. I'm Isabel Charlet.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 6, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we welcome your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Anna Wilcox, Ken Jones, and Barbara Bernstein. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sherry Meredith. Special thanks to Judith Ruiz Branch, Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Edward J. Vieira, and Danielle Smith. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.